I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the KCBX studios in San Luis Obispo. Right now we're with historian Jim Gregory, who lives in the county and taught at Mission and Rio Grande High School for 30 years.
30 years. Retired 2 years ago, and I just live about a mile away from the high school, so I can still hear the bells go off. So,
don't you love it?
Yeah, I can't escape. But then
you wrote a book about Civil War veterans who settled in Rio Grande after the Civil War, and then you wrote a book about the Nisei and Issei of Rio Grande who were interned during World War II. Wonderful book. And now you are fresh off the press with a new book that has everything to do with San Luis Obispo County.
I'm a baby boomer, so I have a fascination. I grew up on, you know, Have Gun, Will Travel, Gun Smoke, Bonanza, Wanted Dead or Alive. So there's always been a fascination with the Old West that I finally decided to turn my attention to my own home county, and amazed to find out this was one of the most violent places in America during the 1850s. In fact, it was the most violent place in America in 1858. I love startling statistics as a historian, so I'm going to spring one on you if it's okay. The most dangerous place in the United States in 2015, according to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, was New Orleans. Had a homicide rate of 47 per 100,000 population. Well, if you'd applied that same methodology to San Luis Obispo County, granted we only had 1,800 people in 1858, but the statistic would have worked out to 178 per 100,000 population. So this was definitely a very dangerous place to live.
That's interesting because you know and I know some of those stories and myth, legend, and lore from back in the day. If you left San Luis Obispo in the 1850s on horseback and you tried to go up the old stagecoach road up the Cuesta Grande, you were taking your life in your hands, and you better have a Winchester with you.
I remember I was a researcher at the County Historical Museum many years ago, and they used to have card catalogs, but they were full of this blue onion skin paper, this elegant Victorian, mid-Victorian handwriting that people used to have. And it turns out they were coroner's report. And I found one and opened it very gently because they're fragile. And it read something like, "Cowboy on Cuesta Grande, cause of death, pistol ball through heart." So that would have been something very typical of especially the 1850s.
These weren't all solo desperados. These were gangs that worked in mass, right? Tell us about their modus operandi.
Well, the most notorious gang leader was an Irish immigrant named Jack Powers, who virtually ran Santa Barbara. For a time, he and his gang lived on the grounds of the Santa Barbara Mission. Powers was everything. He could have been played by Tyrone Power. He was handsome. He was a graceful dancer. He was a superb horseman. In fact, he won a bet in a race in San Francisco. People came out to watch this guy ride horses. 10,000 people at this racetrack, the Exposition Racetrack, which would have been about a sixth of the population of San Francisco in 1858. He pretty much controlled El Camino Real, which is today's Highway 101, between Salinas and Santa Barbara. And it was his gang that did a lot of the robberies and killings. Now, his chief lieutenant was a San Luis Obispo man, a young man named Pio Linares, whose father had once owned what is today Los Osos. He sold out to Captain John Wilson. Pio, the son, had a small ranchita in the hills above Rio Grande High School. So Pio Linares was the local leader of the Powers gang, and he would let Powers know when there was a likely mark on El Camino Real. And the incentive for robbing people came from the gold rush, because Southern California, roughly from the Cuesta on down, was cow country. And just as Levi Strauss found out, the real money wasn't to be made from mining gold. It was supplying the needs of the gold miners. So these cattle buyers and cattle sellers were up and down El Camino Real, often carrying large amounts of money, and they made easy prey for the Jack Powers gang. And Powers' skill as a horseman paid off. He would commit a job. Cuesta Pass was a favorite spot. So was a place called Box Canyon near Los Alamos, south of Santa Maria. And then he would magically appear in Santa Barbara, glad-handing people and playing pool and buying drinks for the house just a few hours later. Well, it turned out there was a local rancher who had a connection with Powers who would loan him fresh horses. And the guy was such a good rider, he could be in Santa Barbara in no time flat. So that was his alibi. The gang would finally go too far in 1858. They would murder a total of five people over the grade, a farmer, two ranchers, and two cattle traders. And it's at that point where the Vigilance Committee was formed. And it was headed by an English immigrant who had come to California with the same infantry regiment that Jack Powers had belonged to from New York. Powers was from Hell's Kitchen. So this Murray would be the founder of the local newspaper, the San Luis Obispo Tribune. He would also be a lawyer. Became very concerned because it was very difficult to convict Californios, Spanish-speaking locals, in the local courts. And he was very alarmed at this. At first glance, you look at a guy like Murray and think, oh, he's bigoted against Spanish-speaking people. Well, there's a couple of flaws in that, because that was the angle I was looking for. I thought, well, this must be a case of some kind of social outlawry, some form of social protest. It turns out that's not quite the case. Murray was married to a Latina, a Chileña, a widow from Chile that he met in the gold fields in Sonora. And I think his real motivation, I found a tintype, he had started a family. And there's Murray holding very gently, with great paternal pride, this little girl. So he had come to San Luis Obispo, married, started a family. And then another clue is his tombstone, which is right across the street from the San Luis Obispo Elks Lodge at the edge of the San Luis Cemetery. He was a Mason, so it has the Masonic symbol at the base of the tombstone. But the inscription by his epitaph is of a man's hand and a woman's hand clasped, saying farewell. So that indicates to me that Murray's primary motivation was that he was a family man, and he didn't want to raise a family in an atmosphere where people were constantly disappearing on El Camino Real.
And in addition to holding up and robbing and murdering of individuals, the Wells Fargo stage was a prime target.
The outlaw who bedeviled Wells Fargo, stagecoach robber extraordinaire, was Dick Fellows. Fellows was a Kentuckian. He came to California. He was to be a hog farmer. There was a disastrous fire that sadly killed off his livestock, so he turned to stagecoach robber. And one of his first jobs was in the San Fernando Valley. He'll eventually make his way to San Luis Obispo County. But he steps into the road, stops the stage, and at that point a passenger leaps off and fires his revolver at Dick Fellows, which prompts the stagecoach driver into confusion to lash the horses into full gallop, and the stagecoach takes off. And then Dick Fellows' horse takes off, following the stagecoach. So there's the passenger and Dick Fellows standing in the roadway staring at each other. So the passenger kind of shrugs and hands his revolver to Fellows, and Fellows says, walk back to San Fernando. His next big job was near Bakersfield, and there was a Wells Fargo stage, and he had a big payroll on board. So he's waiting with his horse at the ambush point. And he lost his first horse, which followed the stagecoach. This time his horse bucked, threw him off, knocked him unconscious at the exact instant the stagecoach passed the ambush point. And he found out later it had $240,000 in a strongbox.
Wow.
But he was a persistent man, so he figured, by golly, I didn't get it going to L.A., but I will get it on return trip from L.A. And this time he succeeded. He stopped to coach. The driver threw down the strongbox, let the stagecoach go. He was heaving the strongbox up onto the pommel of the saddle of another horse he had gotten from a livery, and that horse bolted and took off. Fellows dropped the strongbox on his foot, hurt himself severely. And so in the dark, horseless, he's dragging the strongbox to the face of a cliff he does not see. He falls over the cliff. He breaks his leg. Fortunately, he's on the edge of a Chinese mining camp, so he steals one of the miners' horses. Unfortunately, the horse has just been shot, and it's got three horseshoes and one mule shoe, so it's no mistaking it. You know, so the Kern County Sheriff arrests him shortly thereafter. He does two stints in San Quentin and one in Folsom. He kind of gets to inaugurate Folsom, becomes a chaplain's assistant, a teacher of moral philosophy and Spanish, a model prisoner, so he's paroled. But by golly, he's kind of got into the habit. This is about 1882 or so. So he resumes his career, and he starts robbing coaches in San Luis Obispo County and in Santa Barbara County, San Marcos Pass, two jobs south of Rio Grande, one up near King City. He's finally arrested by a Wells Fargo detective, and he's remanded to the custody of the Santa Barbara County Sheriff for a job in Los Alamos. And he's convicted, and as he's waiting transport to Folsom Prison for his third and final prison term, the deputy of the Santa Barbara County Jail brings him breakfast. Dick Fellows jumps the guy, knocks him to the ground, runs out the street, steals a horse, jumps on a horse, rides pell-mell down Santa Barbara Street, takes a sharp left turn. His horse runs into another horse. Dick Fellows is thrown off, is lying stunned in the street when he's surrounded by a brace of men and one teenage boy with pistols and rifles. He surrenders, goes back to jail, and then he asked a deputy if he might not have his breakfast now.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your book.
The book, it starts with a real natural starting place is the gold rush, because one of the outcomes of that were the group of men who murdered 11 people at Mission San Miguel in 1848. And that itself is a fascinating story. Three of them are deserters from a ship in San Francisco Harbor, a store ship. Two of them are Irish-born, and I found their statements as recorded by the court clerk in Santa Barbara once they were finally captured are at the mission archives in Santa Barbara, along with notes that were passed to and from the various pursuers. But they would murder the Reed family at Mission San Miguel. They would eventually be tracked down, and in a running gunfight off Summerlin, two of them would be shot to death on the beach, and the other three would be executed by a firing squad commanded by Lieutenant Edward O.C. Ord, for whom Fort Ord is named, later to be a Civil War general. So that spectacular crime is really the natural starting point. And then the book goes into the Powers Linares gang, who would have their end come in 1858. Linares would be shot to death at the end of a two-day running gun battle in Los Osos Valley. Six of his cohorts would be hung by the Vigilance Committee in front of the old mission. Interesting is that Linares' house still stands in San Luis Obispo. I won't say where it is because obviously for obvious reasons, but this continued to be a pretty violent place into the late 1800s. And we had visitors. Of course, one chapter deals with desperados like the James brothers. Frank and Jesse lived in 1867-68 on their Uncle Drury's ranch in La Panza district near Paso Robles. That was before they really became known as bank robbers. They would perform their first big job after they got back to Missouri in 1868. They were more or less, I think, on the lam. Family tradition has Jesse came to the hot springs because it was a curative for a gunshot wound he'd received as a Confederate guerrilla. I think it had more to do with the political climate in Missouri. They'd just elected a Republican governor, and it was a good idea for the boys to hide out. The Dalton brothers, another generation, related kind of to the James because their mother was a younger. Bill Dalton lived near Paso Robles as well, had a ranch, was a very well-respected citizen. His brothers came to visit. They liked to practice with their pistols when they were having a barbecue, which was very upsetting because the Estrella Adobe Church was nearby, and they barbecued on a Sunday, and it's kind of hard to pray with all that pistol practice. After Gratt and Bob and two other associates were killed in it, they attempted to rob two banks simultaneously in Coffeyville, Kansas in 1892. Total disaster. Two of the brothers were killed. They had originally been federal marshals, like Rooster Cogburn. They've operated out of Fort Smith, Arkansas. For whatever reason, Bill decided to reform the gang. And his outlaw career, he left Paso Robles, went back to the Southwest, Midwest. His outlaw career only lasted about a year. He was eventually hunted down by a posse and shot to death in what is today Oklahoma. Another chapter is kind of an ethnic history. I wanted to focus on two characters. One of them would be Sheriff Yancey McFadden. Guys, I just love the name. There used to be a disco called Yancey McFadden.
I remember that up on the hill where KSBY is, yeah.
Right. And he was right out of Central Casting. He reminds me a lot of one of my favorite movies with James Dean, East of Eden. And if you remember, Burl Ives plays the Monterey Sheriff in that movie. And that's pretty much how Yancey McFadden was built, kind of like Burl Ives. He was a barrel-shaped man.
And you can see a photo of him at the county courthouse.
Right.
And he was Central Casting, for sure.
He was Central Casting. His biggest case came in 1909, and that was the murder of Ah Louis' wife, Gan Ying, which translates as Silver Dove.
Talk about Ah Louis. He was a labor contractor for the railroad.
He was a labor contractor. They built the railroad connection from Port Harford to San Luis Obispo. They built several local roads. Most of the houses in turn of the century, San Luis Obispo, were built of Ah Louis bricks. He had a brickyard. He had connections to some of my people in the Rio Grande area, like the Routsons and the Wallers. He grew flowers for seed, which was a big industry in the South County. He was a marvelous entrepreneur at a time, and the chapter goes into some detail, when anti-Chinese prejudice was at its height. And eventually, things would become so dangerous for Chinese immigrants here that really about the only families that stuck it out were the Louis family, the Jin family, and also the Chong family.
And Aunt Lewis's store is still there on the corner. Tell us about where it is.
The murder occurred upstairs. The family,
oh, wow.
The family lived, including 8 children. The youngest said, I never even knew there was such a thing as a chicken leg or a chicken breast until I grew up. Because I was the littlest, I always got the last piece. It was the neck. But the family had apartments upstairs, and they reported in morning in 1909 that they'd heard a gunshot. And Gan Ying, who was a beautiful one, since Alois had married her, she'd only left the store twice. Once was for a visit to the dentist. So she was really, mother and family were the center of her life, and she was determined to raise good children, which she did, because the children were remarkable in many different ways. Yancey McFadden arrives, and Alois comes back from Rio Grande, where he'd gone to check on a seed flower farm. And there are missing jewelry and a missing cash box. So the motive is robbery. But Gan Ying, Silver Dove, is how it translates, was shot while she was asleep. She's facing the wall. Her toddler baby Howard, who just died a few years ago, he lived to be almost 100 years old, was sleeping with her. And there's the bullet hole is midway between temple and cheekbone. There's powder burns. So she apparently was asleep. Why was she murdered? It turns out that McFadden follows the trail to San Francisco. Alois' son, Willie, from a first marriage, had taken, accompanied Gan Ying in her casket to San Francisco to be repatriated to China for burial. And Yancey McFadden followed, started asking lots of questions. Within 3 days, he issued a warrant and arrested Willie Lewis, who made a full confession in the county jail, which was then in the basement of the old county courthouse, the one that Alex Madonna knocked down in 1939. And they found cash in his chest of drawers. They found jewelry buried in a garden. And McFadden ordered the cesspool behind the store to be pumped out, and there they found a .38 Colt revolver. So Willie Lewis was convicted in a trial where he understood barely anything that was going on. And it was easy. The conviction was easy. The hard part was the penalty phase. There was vociferous opposition to the death penalty in California in 1909. There were bills before the assembly to abolish the death penalty. And it took the jury several ballots to agree on sentencing Willie Lewis to death. Unfortunately for Willie Lewis, the penalty phase of the trial was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And after the fifth ballot, everybody wanted to go home. So 3 years later, after several appeals had failed and several bills to abolish the death penalty had died in the state legislature, Willie Lewis would be hanged at San Quentin.
And the motive was?
A, it was avarice, and B, he hated his stepmother. He said she was constantly reminding him that he would not inherit, that her children would. He, on the other hand, was not exactly a straight arrow. He kept a little cabin in behind the store where a woman named Nettie, a live-in prostitute, lived, which was hardly the kind of thing that a respectful woman like Gan Ying would have tolerated. So there's this tremendous tension building between the two. And in that tiny place with 8 children over the store, I think he snapped. And it was a terrific tragedy.
I think you have the script for a Hollywood movie myself.
Well, it just, the Chinese connection even ties into the lynching in Rio Grande in 1886, when a father and 15-year-old son were hanged from the Pacific Coast Railway Bridge at the foot of Crown Hill. They had murdered a farmer and his wife in Lopez Canyon. The lynch mob appears, breaks them out what passed for jail, and takes them down Olahan Alley to the PCR bridge and throws them off. It turns out that only 7 weeks before, this is 1886, and that's important because this is, again, at the height of anti-Chinese bigotry. The farmer and his son weren't Chinese. He was a Swiss immigrant. But only a few weeks before they were lynched, a similar mob had showed up in Rio Grande in what was then Chinatown and ordered the Chinese residents to get out within 3 weeks or they'd be killed. And only a few days after the lynching in Rio Grande, another mob similarly had handkerchiefs over their faces just as they had when they broke into the jail, jumped a road gang that was building railroad PCR track, lane track between...
And that PCR, Pacific Coast Railway.
Lane track between Rio Grande and Napomo, and warned that Chinese road gang to get out within 48 hours or they would come back and hang them. So this is a time of tremendous societal tension, and it expressed itself in a lynching that came 30 years anyway, after the lynchings of the Vigilance Committee. So that's kind of always been a Rio Grande's dark and not so mysterious secret because the story has been told and told well by other people. But it is just so shocking for such a peaceful little town, my hometown where I grew up, to have hanged a 15-and-a-half-year-old boy. And by the two were finally buried, ironically, because they would not be permitted burial on consecrated ground. They had shot a farmer. They'd also shot his wife, who died 7 months later as a result of the gunshot wounds. So they couldn't be buried in consecrated ground. So ironically, the person who offered them a burial place was Manuela Branch, who was the wife of the founder of Arroyo Grande, a very wealthy landowner. And the father and son, the Hemis, what are their name? They're buried in the Branch family graveyard, in the corner of the graveyard.
And the Branch homestead is still there?
Branch homestead is still there, and the site for the adobe is still there, and down the hill, Manuela had a redwood house there. One of the sons of Ramon, the Tally Vineyard's tasting room, was originally Ramon's ranch house back in the day. And, of course, I went to Branch School, so that goes it figures naturally that I would be interested in a story that involved Manuela Branch. From there, we go to the Roaring Twenties, all kinds of fun things going on. 2 years after the Motel Inn was completed, it was robbed at gunpoint by a man who was later turned out to be the undersheriff of San Luis Obispo County. He was acquitted. The same lawyer that had convicted Willie Lewis was his defense lawyer. And this guy was good. He so rattled the witnesses that the guy was eventually acquitted, although he had a little problem with drinking and driving after that. At one point, driving 80 miles an hour through downtown San Luis Obispo with the police in hot pursuit, they finally shot out his tires on the campus of the high school. We had another a child prodigy violinist named Eleanor, who at 7 years old played the Star Spangled Banner at a Bull Moose rally for Teddy Roosevelt in, of all places, wait for it, the Lompoc Opera House. How about that? Lompoc. Her dad was the owner and manager, and Eleanor was charming, captivating. She acted in plays. She really was good at the violin. Eventually, they will live for a short time in Arroyo Grande. They'll have a play, have a dance band at a roadhouse in Avila Beach. And then Eleanor kind of goes away for a few years, and it's said she goes off to vaudeville to follow her heart. Well, when she shows up again, it's with a revolver in her hand and two accomplices, and they rob the Taft State Bank, right over the county line in Taft, of $5,800, which was the equivalent of $80,000 today. So she and her cohorts are captured. She becomes the focus of attention for several weeks in Bakersfield and Los Angeles and even San Luis newspapers as the bob-haired bandit, because she cuts her hair short. It's the 1920s. And she turns state's evidence, and ironically, her accomplice is acquitted, and she's convicted. She goes to San Quentin. I didn't know women went to San Quentin. They did. The bob-haired bandit goes to San Quentin. Eventually, Eleanor will be paroled. She'll live in San Francisco, list her profession as musician. But there are several robberies in East Bay and in San Francisco of drugstores and banks by two women dressed as men. And when Eleanor robbed the Taft State Bank, sure enough, she was dressed as a man. Amy Semple McPherson, the evangelist who faked her own death, stayed overnight at the hotel in San Luis Obispo where the City County Library now stands, on her way to what the 1920s papers called a love nest in Carmel. And, of course, places like Spooner's Cove, San Simeon, Pirate's Cove were all ideal for bootlegging and rum running. And that includes Al Capone. I found a Chicago newspaper article that indicated that one of Capone's favorite places to run Canadian whiskey on shore was the central coast of California. And there were occasional pitched gunfights on the beach in San Simeon. A butcher was shot to death. He was out surf fishing in the 1920s and off Oceano. Then he ran into a gang who was waiting for a shipment to come on shore. My favorite, because I was able to get a photograph from a former sheriff named Tim Stewart, my favorite is Sheriff Jess Lowry pulls over a lumber truck off of Pismo Beach in 1928, and he starts taking the 2x4s off the truck, and underneath there are jerry cans with 1,000 gallons of Canadian whiskey. It was the biggest bust of Sheriff Lowry's, and there's a wonderful picture of him posing proudly beside the truck in front of the county courthouse. One of the last big busts that they made was of a guy named Pico Cornero. And Pico Cornero was the younger brother of Tony Cornero, who was not only a bootlegger, he would eventually die either of a heart attack or Lucky Luciano, depending on your version. He's the guy who became famous later, after Prohibition had ended, for having a string of gambling ships anchored just off the three-mile limit off places like Santa Monica. And it would eventually be one of the founders of Las Vegas. But Pico was arrested near Cayucas, and then a few months later arrested north of Santa Barbara for bootlegging. This place was spectacular in terms of breaking the law.
This is all in your book.
Yeah.
You make a person long for the good old days.
I have to admit, this book was fun to research. The World War II book, following the lives of young men who would lose their lives, or following the lives of what happened to my Japanese-American friends when they went to places like Gila River, that was sometimes pretty desperate work. It got emotionally tough. This book, I have to admit, it was a lot of fun.
I can hardly wait for the movie version.
Well, we even have two train robbers who actually operated over in the valley, but one of them lived here and was a gold miner in La Ponta District when they had a gold rush there. And doggone it, I started reading about them, and it's just exactly this Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. They used a little bit too much dynamite on a train in Pixley. Eventually, they would be followed by a posse hired by Southern Pacific that was shuttled around the Central Valley by railroad cars, just like the posse that chased Robert Redford and Paul Newman. And they would have a final desperate gunfight, and one of them would be fatally wounded, and he said, "I'm not going to make it. I'll cover for you. You get out." Sure enough, he did. The other guy, he didn't get far, but they were good friends to the end. Took great joy in robbing trains, and railroad wasn't all that popular in the 1890s, so there were some elements of farmers in the Central Valley who said, well, good on them, more power to them.
To learn more about your book and to order the book and the name of the book again.
The book is San Luis Obispo County Outlaws, Desperados, Vigilantes, and Bootleggers. It'll be available on Amazon.com. It'll be at Barnes & Noble. If you go to my website, which is very simple, www.orelgrandehistory.com, I'll start listing book signings where you can find me at various places around the county signing books, and you can buy a book there.
Jim Gregory, thanks for sharing. What a great, adventurous day.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
We've been visiting with historian Jim Gregory. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the KCBX studios in San Luis Obispo.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.